soldiers died, so it's a fraction compared to the Vietnamese statistics. Do you think this is a weakness of the documentary also? Would you have liked to have seen this more?
I think the film struggles slightly actually to know how to end and how to conclude, because it doesn't do that. It doesn't wrap up with a summary of, because these events are the final events of the Vietnam War. It could very naturally then have a conclusion which wraps up the entire history of a two decade conflict, but it doesn't do that. And I think I probably welcome the fact it doesn't, because it would turn it into something else. I mean, it does deal with high level politics at some points. You know, it deals with decisions that have to be made by U.S. generals and the U.S. ambassador in Saigon. But it does try to bring it back to the experience of more ground level. People on both sides, mm-hmm. Or Americans and South Vietnamese, wherever it can. I think if it just gave us a load of figures and statistics at the end, it would be a little bit unfaithful to the film it has been before, really. So I think it tries to end on, as we see there, on a more human, a more sorrowful note. Mm. And I think it tries to give a sense of the futility of war generally on the human level. I'm not sure it does that entirely powerfully. I'm not sure it does that as powerfully as it does, as it achieves other things throughout the film. But I think I welcome it trying to end on that note.
Which is fair enough, I suppose. And Lindsay, I mean, the US lost at least 58,000 troops. Mm. And I've read in my research that this is still a controversial issue as to the US narrative is that they didn't win the war, they didn't lose the war. Why is this such a still controversial issue?
I think it's a very big question still in America. I mean, obviously, the surviving veterans and the surviving anti-war protesters come to that are now older. You know, they're now quite old. They're people who are sort of pensioner age and so on. It's still a very contested thing. There's still a very contested thing. Was it justified? There's still many, many veterans who are disabled and who are mentally and physically ill as a result of the war. And, of course, America doesn't like losing wars. I mean, this is Trump's election. You know, he says we don't mind going to war, but we want to be able to win those wars. And, of course, Vietnam showed them they couldn't win the wars despite this huge superior air power and military might in general, despite targeting quite deliberately civilians, which they did, who they claimed were sort of hiding the Viet Cong and the people who were fighting. Despite all this, they lost, and they lost because of what the Vietnamese people themselves did. They lost because their own soldiers didn't have the faith in it that perhaps they might have done in previous wars. And they lost because the people at home said, look, we don't want this either. So I think it's still a very big issue in American politics. And, of course, it's contemporary in the sense that there was what was called the Vietnam Syndrome, which did stop these interventions for the best part of 20 years. Mm-hmm. And now we're back with a vengeance with all of those.
Well, it's really great to see how it relates to today as well. And I'm afraid we'll have to leave the discussion here. I wish we could talk longer. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
On the occasion of the National Day of Resilience, tens of thousands of people marched in Sana'a on March 26th to reaffirm their steadfastness as the Saudi-led war entered its 8th year. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by staff of Crescent International. This article is published under the heading Yemenis, allies and supporters hold mass rallies to condemn Saudi-led war of aggression. Here's more. Marking the 7th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, tens of thousands of Yemenis marched in Sana'a, the capital city, to condemn the ongoing Saudi aggression. There were similar rallies in other cities of Yemen. To express solidarity with the oppressed people of Yemen, hundreds of people in different cities of Canada also held rallies. Ottawa, the windy Canadian capital city, as well as Hamilton, held rallies. In Ottawa, hundreds of demonstrators who have traveled from Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa, and other cities marched from Global Affairs Canada, Foreign Ministry Building, to Parliament Hill to remind politicians that they are complicit in Saudi crimes against innocent Yemeni people. Canada is supplying $15 billion worth of light armored vehicles, LAVs, to Saudi Arabia that are being used against the Yemeni people as well as citizens of Saudi Arabia in clear violation of the terms of the agreement. While claiming to uphold human rights, successive Canadian governments, including the current Liberal-led government, have turned a blind eye to egregious Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people. The Saudis have also imposed a crippling siege of Yemen, preventing food and fuel from entering the country. The UN says that since March 2015, when the Saudis launched the war against Yemen, some 377,000 people have died, a large number of them children. At least 1 million children are suffering from cholera, the highest infection of the preventable disease in the world. Despite Saudi barbarism, the people of Yemen have not been cowed down. On the occasion of the National Day of Resilience, tens of thousands of people marched in Sana'a on March 26 to reaffirm their steadfastness as the Saudi-led US-backed war entered its 8th year. A day earlier, on March 25th, the Yemeni revolutionaries hit Saudi oil facilities at Ras Tanura and other cities with missile-armed drones, causing massive damage to such facilities. The Saudi oil storage facilities near Jeddah, where the Formula One car race practice was taking place, caused not only damage but also panic. The Formula One race was postponed. On March 26th, the anniversary of the Saudi-led, US-backed war of aggression, chairman of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, announced a three-day halt to strikes against Saudi forces and facilities. These included a halt to ground operations as well. Instead of responding to the offer of a three-day truce, the Saudis launched devastating airstrikes against residential areas of Sana'a on March 27th. A medical center in the coastal town of Makrum on Camaran Island was attacked in the early hours of Sunday, March 27th, according to Yemen's Arabic language Al Masira television network. The report added that six civilians, including three children, were injured in the Saudi airstrikes. Several other residential neighborhoods were also bombed. While the Saudis have on several occasions called for a ceasefire and end to hostilities, when the Ansarullah offered a three-day truce that could be extended, the Saudis resorted to their barbaric practices of targeting civilians. That is why the March 26 rallies in Yemen pledging allegiance to Ansarullah and vowing to continue the resistance until the aggressors are defeated was so important. Waving Yemeni flags, the participants chanted the slogans like "Death to America" and "Death to Israel." Even as the war enters its eighth year, the Saudis have nothing but humiliation awaiting them.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Indigenous groups from Canada are visiting the Vatican this week for meetings with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. They have held a meeting with the Pope discussing the Church's role in a system of boarding schools that abused Indigenous children for over 100 years as part of a government policy of forced assimilation. That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples, referred to as a process of healing and reconciliation. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves since last May at the schools attended by Indigenous children has opened old wounds. The residential schools were funded by the Canadian government and administered by churches. Canada's Indigenous people are now calling on the Pope to formally apologize as the head of the Catholic Church for its role in administering the facilities.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
The plea was made in a nearly one-hour meeting between the pontiff and representatives of two of Canada's three largest Indigenous communities, the Métis and Inuit Nations. More than 30 delegates visiting the Vatican say an apology from Francis in Canada would be an important step in the healing process. Survivors of Canada's residential schools have also called on Pope Francis to provide them with unlimited access to church records on the institutions where thousands of Indigenous children were sexually abused and mistreated over the years.
In my opinion, the apology by the Pope would have a limited value. in that it would show that the church is recognizing its culpability and responsibility for the crimes that were committed against First Nations. The real issue of reconciliation would be the release of documentation and papers concerning the residential schools, which to date the church has not done.
Over the years, the Pope has expressed his sorrow and sadness for the survivors of residential schools in Canada, but has stopped short of apologizing. Canada has been home to people for thousands of years and was first colonized by Europeans in the 16th century. Settlers took over and began to control indigenous peoples. Colonizers imposed their own cultural values, religions, and laws, made policies that did not favor the indigenous peoples. The nominal objective of residential schools was to educate indigenous children, but the explicit objective was to create a system to isolate them from their own native culture and religion to assimilate them into the white Canadian settlers' culture. The Catholic Church operated nearly three-quarters of Canada's residential schools, seizing more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes between 1830s and mid-1990s, spending months or years isolated from their families, language, and culture. Many of the Indigenous children taken from their homes by the church school system were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition. An estimated 6,000 First Nation children died while attending the schools, and the search for more graves goes on. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded in 2015 the failed government policy amounted to cultural genocide.
It would bring, as I said, recognition that they have culpability, and that's been lacking thus far. The church has denied any responsibility for things that happened. They claimed that it was a good thing and that it would help, but what it did was it was a form of genocide. It was cultural genocide, and the church has to claim responsibility for that.
Pope Francis has heard firsthand the horrors of crimes committed at church-run residential schools in Canada from Indigenous survivors. That's a positive step in acknowledging the Church's role in this scandal. But will the Catholic Church and Pope Francis offer more than words?
Top diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt, and the United States hold a summit in the Negev Desert. Foreign ministers of the Arab countries hold talks with Israeli officials to discuss bilateral relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also took part in the Negev summit.
Israel is trying to achieve something that it basically has not achieved for most of its history. Namely, it is to gang up on the Palestinians and the Arab countries that support the Palestinians.
The controversial summit comes as Tel Aviv is pressing ahead with its expansionist policies, including settlement construction on occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the meeting. Hamas said the meeting is a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots against Palestine and its people. Hamas reiterated its absolute rejection of all forms of normalization with the occupying regime, stressing that such meetings only serve the enemy in perpetuating its continuous aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites. The resistance movement also called on the Arab countries that signed the Abraham Accords with Israel to reconsider their move to honor their historical responsibilities to protect Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad said on Sunday that the Negev summit reflects the loss of Arab identity of all those who agreed to be part of the enemy's normalization project. Meanwhile, the Deputy Secretary General of Bahrain's Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society also condemned the meeting, warning that the Bahraini regime was making a miscalculation. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Bahrain and Morocco followed suit, while Sudan also agreed to normalize ties with Israel. Also recently, the Saudi Crown Prince described Israel as a potential ally. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. The normalization of ties with Israel, with a strong U.S. support, is widely considered as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. However, despite opposition from Palestinians, the Arab countries seem to be obsessed with the economic benefits of establishing ties with Israel. They are getting close to the regime at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians. This seems to have further emboldened the regime in Tel Aviv to escalate its crimes. The regime is killing Palestinians on a daily basis. Israeli forces and settlers killed 319 Palestinians, including 71 minors, in 2021. That's the highest number since 2014. Also, 895 Palestinians were left homeless this year after 295 residential structures were demolished, the highest number since 2016. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities. Israel also keeps hundreds of Palestinians in its prisons under the infamous administrative detention policy, which allows the regime to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial.
The options that are left for Palestinians are to continue unending resistance against Israel. This is really the only option. The more resistance they can do, the requirement here is to make the resistance so unlivable for the Israelis that the Israeli population will move away.
For more than four decades, the UN Security Council and General Assembly have stated in so many resolutions that construction of Israeli settlements in occupied territories are illegal and annexation of occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. But Israel continues its activities with impunity, and that's mainly blamed on Washington's unabated support for Israel, whether financially, militarily, or even through brokering normalization ties with other states.
Thousands of Yemenis have staged mass protests across the country, including the capital Sana'a, on the National Day of Resilience, the day when the Saudi-led coalition began its aggression on Yemen. The demonstrators marked the seventh anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country, denounced the aggression, and expressed their support for resistance against the Saudi-led invasion. The demonstrations followed a wave of retaliatory drone and missile attacks that hit targets across Saudi Arabia.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company, Aramco, were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. This is the Yemeni army's highest profile attack yet on the kingdom. The army vowed to continue the retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its years-long aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. Retaliatory missile and drone strikes against oil storage facilities in Saudi Arabia rekindled concerns over supply shortages as crude oil prices surged and broke the $120 level. The news added fuel to the already volatile oil market, shadowed by supply risks related to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against Yemen, targeting the country's facilities in the provinces of Hodeidah and Sana'a, killing at least eight people. The coalition has hit oil facilities in Hodeidah. That violates a 2018 ceasefire deal that ended months of fighting in the city, which handles about 70% of Yemen's commercial and humanitarian imports. The air raids also hit the nearby Port Salif, also on the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia's warmongering policies in Yemen have so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, injured tens of thousands and displaced millions. However, the war has stopped well shy of its goals, as the Yemeni army is gaining momentum by striking a heavy blow against the Riyadh regime. It's high time Saudis realize that they are on the losing side of the war, one in which militarily they are defeated while endangering their jewel Aramco.
Certainly, they are losing this war. The Yemeni government, the Yemeni military is growing in strength since the beginning of the war. They are developing their own weapons and also relying on their allies to provide them with weapons. This recent strike was very targeted, very calculated, and was a big surprise to Saudi Arabia.
Yemen has announced a three-day unilateral ceasefire suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announced the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Meshaat said Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He said Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Following Meshaat's declaration, the spokesman for Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Mohammed Abdulsalam, took to Twitter, urging Saudi Arabia to show a positive reaction to the announcement and prove that it's serious about peace. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. The leader of the popular Ansarullah movement, Abdulmalik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
The United States should be supporting the people of Yemen in this war of aggression against them, but instead it is supporting the very powerful Saudi government. And it is, as you said, providing bombs, other weaponry, logistics, all kinds of aid to Saudi Arabia in their brutal and illegal war of aggression against the people of Yemen.
It has been around a month since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the West has shown unabated support for Kyiv by denouncing Moscow's actions, providing military equipment for Ukraine, and the biased coverage of the war by Western media. Conversely, Western nations have seemingly forgotten that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, one that the U.S. and several Western states have contributed to its making by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi-led coalition.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by US and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
The ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched in the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. But the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, to Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories, and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand. In recent days, Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted again Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up. But it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Nowruz in Travelogues. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Nowruz has impacted foreign travelers and tourists so deeply that many of them have prepared accounts on what they had seen in Iran during this ancient feast. As it was said in the previous episode, many of these foreigners were politicians and spies who have registered their experiences of Nowruz in Iran in order to get familiar with every minute custom among Iranians. This has been done to pave the way for cultural colonialism. Today, we're going to touch upon the accounts of some other foreigners who have ridden on Nowruz in Iran. Stay tuned, please. Among various sources on Nowruz in Iran, the book At the Presence of Sultan Sahib Qaran more descriptively deals with this issue. The writer of the book is Heinrich Karl Brusch, German traveler of the 19th century. He has registered his findings on Nowruz during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar, known as Sultan Sahib Qaran. He writes, Nowruz feast was near. The word Nowruz is for almost all Iranians a magic and miraculous word. With hearing the word, the hearts beat and faces smile, and in the hope of a better future in the coming Nowruz, they tolerate all their present hardships and problems, and they wish for the coming of Nowruz in the whole year. Brusch has pointed to the long history of Nowruz. He continues, Nowruz coincides with the end of winter and the turn of zodiac pieces and a start of a spring. The prevalence of astrology and astronomy during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar had attracted the German traveler, as he writes elsewhere in his book, Iranian astronomers look for auspicious and inauspicious hours and get good wages by determining these hours for the king and princes. From a few days before Nowruz, they try to determine the time of the sun's turn to pieces with the exactness of seconds and announce it to enable people to do their traditional ceremonies. Thank you. German traveler of the 19th century, Heinrich Karl Busch, writes in his accounts on Nowruz, confectionaries have prospered and they supply different kinds of original Iranian sweets. This traveler continues, for Nowruz feast, Iranians usually grow flowers in their small homes or vases, which begin with the letter S, including sombol, meaning hyacinth. This way, they celebrate the awakening of the nature after a long winter sleep. Bursch narrates on the Qajarid king's presence in Buzar before Nowruz, writing, as the king intended to go to Buzar, Sabze Meydan Square would be cordoned off and nobody was allowed to enter. Only the Shah's entourage and courtiers were allowed to enter. The book of the German traveler says that the two kinds of greetings, namely the minor greeting and the public greeting, were among the requirements of Nowruz. Minor greeting belonged to family and relatives and was done on the 1st of Farvardin, in the interior of royal citadel. But public greeting was done differently. The Shah would sit on the throne at the porch of the tall palace, looming over the large yard near the square so that he could see everyone in the large yard. This porch had long and large curtains which would be drawn away. The participants of the public greeting, including officers, high-ranking officials, the nobility, clergymen, VIPs, and princes, who would line up in different places which had already been determined to see the Shah with pomp and glory. British diplomat Robert Kerr Porter, some 200 years ago, had traveled to Iran. He writes in 1819 on what he had seen in Tehran during Nowruz. I arrived in Arg Square on the first day of Nowruz feast. People were there from every group and class. After the entrance door, I entered the interior of Arg, where the Shah would receive his subjects. After a while, I was in the enclosure of the palace. The Shah came and sat on the throne. The attending nobility congratulated him and received their gift, and the ceremony was ended. Karsten Nebhur was a German tourist and cartographer who traveled to Iran during the Zandia rule. He was one of the few travelers who have written unbiased accounts on Iranian customs and traditions. Nebhur writes in 1765, on March 19th, I was drawing at home. Villagers thought that I was making preparations for Nowruz feast. The Iranian Nowruz is the day that has existed in the ancient era. The German tourist continues, on March 20th, corresponding with Farvardin first, villagers had put on better clothes and they didn't work on this day. Wearing better clothes and not working were the only things that this day was a feast, and since it was the month of Ramadan, they were not allowed to eat anything in daytime. Of course, at night, they compensated for the day's fasting, but in full calm and tranquility. Interestingly, most travelers wrote their accounts on Nowruz when the feast coincided with the month of Ramadan or Muharram. Thus, they would witness that people would observe religious rituals and would prefer them to national customs and feasts. Frederick Charles Richards was an American who had traveled to Iran during the rule of Reza Khan Pahlavi. In part of his book on Nowruz, he writes, Iranians believe in this old tradition that anyone who, before speaking a word, eats something sweet in the morning of Nowruz and oils his body, no bad incident will occur to him. Nearly all people go to bath and put on new clothes. Richards points to Nowruz customs in Isfahan and writes, when the ceremonies of mourning of Nowruz end, those people of Isfahan who are able rush toward to the river Zoya and Eru to stay there till afternoon and evening. They have adhered to the custom of narration and reciting of Shahnameh and the story of Rostam and Sohrab. And they are engaged in singing around the historical bridges of Isfahan at the banks of Zoya and Eru.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of the speech delivered on March 10th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with God on earth. You're very welcome, honorable gentlemen and dear brothers. It gladdens me to see that this is a very important meeting has been organized at the appointed time with the participation of all the friends. According to Mr. Raisi's report, the discussions are followed up seriously. I hope that God will help you and accept your endeavors. I wish to congratulate you on the Sha'bani Eids, in particular the 15th of Sha'ban Eid, which is the day when the dreams of the entire humanity throughout history blossom. I hope that God, the Exalted, will show us that day, the day of the reappearance. And I hope that it will happen very soon. Even excluding these Eids, the month of Sha'ban would remain a very important month.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The month when the Holy Prophet, greetings be upon him, and his household, fasted and kept a vigil with great enthusiasm, and he showed great humility in respecting and commemorating this month, day and night, and he did so until his demise. The Holy Prophet would treat this month like this until the end of his life. In the Sha'baniya prayer we read, O God, aid us in following his tradition. This exciting prayer that has been narrated in this month is a sign of the greatness of this month. The sections that exist in this holy and dear prayer have very few peers. Of course,
all the prayers that have been narrated by the Imams, greetings be upon them, are meaningful and instructive. All of them are extraordinary, those who are clearly narrated by the Imams, but this prayer really has few peers.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For 8 years, Donbas, a region of eastern Ukraine that did not accept the results of the Kyiv coup in 2014, has been under frequent shelling from national battalions and the armed forces of Ukraine. Residents of Donbas called it a war crime against the people, and from that moment Ukraine ceased to be a state in their eyes. According to Russian investigators, the actions of the Ukrainian military led to the deaths of more than 2,600 civilians, while more than 5,500 people were injured. 2,200 civilian infrastructure facilities were destroyed.
This is a town, a school number 50 of the sadly known town of Gorlovka in the Donbas region, which is being shelled regularly.
The last time it was shelled by Ukrainian artillery on 24th of February, the teachers died on the spot. But one of the heaviest recent shellings, hushed up by the Western media, happened on March 14 in Donetsk. The Ukrainian military hit the center of the city with a Tochka-U tactical missile equipped with a cluster warhead. The rocket was shot down, but due to the fall of debris, 23 people died and 18 were injured.
The special operation of Russia is our opportunity to defend ourselves, the possibility that the Donbas will not be destroyed and hundreds of thousands of civilians will not be lost due to the Ukrainian aggression. We will be able to remain ourselves. We will be able to speak Russian, our native language, with which we were born and studied. We will have the right to relate to the history and results of the Great Patriotic War without manipulation. Our grandfathers and great-grandfathers can be considered the winners against fascism and in no other way. Thanks to Russia's special operation, joy and hope for a just future appeared in the Donbas.
The ultimate goal of our republic is to hold a referendum in which the people exercise their constitutional right and express their opinion on joining the Russian Federation. I'm sure that's exactly what will happen. The vast majority of the inhabitants of the Luhansk Republic have been living for 8 years under constant shelling and being in an economic and political blockade, experiencing the mockery and horrors of the Nazi battalions of Ukraine. They felt support only from the Russian Federation. With hope and a dream in our hearts, we are waiting for the opportunity to become part of the Russian Federation, to return, as they said in the Crimea, to our native harbour and start working on a great future.
The emotional answer of the head of the LPR to Press TV about holding a referendum on joining Russia caused a wide response. Later he explained that the main task facing the leadership of the LPR now is the completion of hostilities. According to him, the battalions of Ukrainian nationalists are responsible for the murder, torture, robbery and rape of civilians in Donbas. Most of them are relied on the experience of the commanders of the SS division during the World War II, and here in the settlement of Trehizbionka, still terrified. People did not believe in liberation and whispered about how they were bullied and subjected to violence. Here, the LPR servicemen found torture chambers with Nazi symbols hung up and the remains of those who simply disappeared from the village one day without a trace. The documents and an armaments depot were left by terrorist organization Right Sector. The LDPR military and People's Militia say they collected documents about cases of cruelty against the population of Donbas and people from other regions of Ukraine. The documents include photos of people killed by bombing, runic symbols and signs of national battalions, facts of war crimes against humanity, and the positions of battalions in settlements with caches of weapons of mass destructions. Numerous residents of the recently liberated Volnovakha told Press TV that when the Russian forces entered their town, Ukrainian battalions left all the civilian property destroyed. Residents of the city were forbidden to evacuate, and looting had begun.
I am the chief physician of the Volnovakha District Hospital. This is what is left. This is our outpatient polyclinic building. We were in the basements. We all worked and provided assistance to the victims. Our employee died during a shelling from the Ukrainian side. Only on March 13, we were able to get out. There were heavy weapons of the Ukrainian forces on the territory of our hospital. All international conventions prohibit the presence of armed forces in civilian facilities. We asked them to leave the hospital many times and were told that they were given the order to destroy it during retreat.
In Lugansk, servicemen showed tanks and heavy weapons left by Ukrainian militants in the liberated cities and towns. All captured grenade launchers and ammunition, armored personnel carriers, tanks and grenade launchers are productions of the UK, US, Turkey and NATO countries. Donbas leaders and citizens emphasize that the ongoing military operation of Russia was only a response to the criminal acts of Kyiv against Donbas as a timely and preemptive measure. Today, Moscow says it has documents with proof that Kyiv was preparing a large-scale attack and intended to destroy the DNR and LNR.
Russia says its aim over the past months has been to target Ukrainian military infrastructure to prevent the enemy from regrouping and reinforcing its presence in the Donbas. It says it will press ahead with a strategy until the whole region is liberated. Marina Kartunova, Lugansk region.
Peace will have no losers, and a prolonged conflict is not in anyone's interest. This is how Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan opened the face-to-face Russian-Ukrainian negotiations in Istanbul on Tuesday. Erdogan sounded optimistic as he assured Turkey's readiness to host a meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian presidents, whom both he referred to as valuable friends. A Ukrainian negotiator told reporters that they made a series of proposals during the talks to the Russian delegation, which included a demand from Ukraine to have 8 countries as guarantors, including Turkey. While Ukraine can guarantee not having foreign military bases, meaning it would not join military alliances. Ukraine's proposal also includes a 15-year consultation period on the status of annexed Crimea. However, it could only come into force in case of a complete ceasefire.
Ukraine wants to see 8 countries, including Turkey, the US, the UK, France and Germany, as guarantor states to legally actively protect Ukraine from any aggression.
Meanwhile, the Russian negotiator said they will convey Ukraine's suggestions to the Russian president, while describing the talks as constructive. Medin